Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay. And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of the Ink Black Heart, this time covering chapters 68 through 72 of part 4. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of the Ink Black Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get into this chapter, we have one bit of news that we can get into. And I feel like Joe must have somehow felt our complaints last week from when we were saying there's no news. So she gave us a little morsel. She changed her Twitter header.
I think she saw that it was Bill's birthday because everyone was wishing him happy birthday and then changed it.
Definitely. I think that seems more likely. She's not actually clairvoyant.
I feel like Bill should have a lot more birthdays. We should just all start wishing him happy birthday at random times and see what we get.
See if she notices.
Not too often, it'll be suspicious, but at least a half birthday.
Yeah.
But yeah, she updated her Twitter header and it looks like it might be AI generated. I don't think anybody was able to find it on a reverse Google image search, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it looks like a woman who might have either drowned or been found in water or something. It's really creepy though.
Yeah, I don't think it's drowning because that's not a crime.
I mean, unless somebody holds them underwater.
Or like takes them out and makes them walk the plank.
So this is a pirate book.
I wouldn't be opposed.
Would you be opposed to Pirate Strike?
He's got the peg leg.
Yeah.
He can borrow Kia's parrot and he's all set.
I guess I was taking that to mean accidental drowning. I think that someone's going to dump this body in the water.
We were predicting that, but
Yes.
to be fair, it seemed like a pretty good prediction.
I think a lot of us were thinking that. Yeah.
And the thing you said about it being AI generated, Kens, to me, I've been playing around with AI art for the past few weeks just for fun. And to me, it has the look of AI art. The hands are a bit messed up because the AI art tends to spit out hands that have like a few too many fingers or really weird proportions or weird angles.
Yeah.
And the length and skinniness of the arm also kind of looks a bit AI to me. And then I was going down the rabbit hole of what if AI art is the clue? What if the AI is part of the Running Grave? And I was like, no, because that's too close to Ink Black Heart. So maybe not.
It does kind of look like a woman, though. Like the
Oh,
black
yeah.
parts on the right side to me kind of look like hair.
Yeah, I had thought hair. I was also thinking it was a shadow of the waves, so it's the
Could
darker
be.
part. The squid, if that's what it is on.
Where's the squid on there?
On the top, the orange. I thought it looked like a squid.
That's an AI messed up hand, in my opinion.
Really?
Like a really messed up AI hand.
Okay. I mean, it's orange.
Yeah, that's AI.
Yeah, I think that that's
Okay.
just a funky looking hand.
I guess it could be like an octopus.
Yeah, because it seems like it's a person who's laying on their back with their right arm folded across their
Yeah,
body.
okay. It just looks like a squid.
It looks like she has hot dog fingers from, Everything Everywhere All at Once. She's a hot dog finger of the
Oh,
world.
dear. I think the point is that if it's AI, I think we agree that it is.
I think
These
it is,
kinds of
yeah.
details, whether or not it's a squid or a hand, whether it's the hair or it's not, I
Yeah.
don't think we can really focus on those kinds of
No,
details.
because they'll just be AI artifacts.
Yeah.
I agree with you there.
I think that she wanted a picture of a woman's body floating in the water,
Yes,
played
I
around with it
agree.
till it worked, and then picked one.
That reminds me of that tweet that she posted whenever she was asking for all those predictions. The one about the daughter dying. The
Yeah,
person was
yeah.
like, oh, yeah, the daughter dies. And she's like, wow, that's all I have to say to that.
Yeah, I thought of the same thing because whoever this woman is could be the daughter of a client, like we had
Yep.
thought. I've even seen people try and connect it to the commune, a daughter, something with that.
Could be.
I want this book so fucking badly.
I know my patience is running out at this point.
Oh, thank God we only hopefully have a few more weeks until we get a synopsis or some sort of extra breadcrumbs we can have to go off of.
The synopsis is going to be so exciting. It changes
So
everything.
exciting. It really does, yeah.
And then I guess after the synopsis is when we'll have to start asking people for predictions.
Yes.
Because we already have some predictions, but that's when we can really dive in.
Dive deep into it.
I'm excited because prediction episodes are my favorite. I love
Yeah.
doing predictions.
This header is one of the most exciting ones for me because
I think so.
it's really dark. I feel like she knows that we do reverse image searches. And maybe that's why she did it this way.
Yep. I think so too. Yeah.
She has to be aware because she is, I think we all know at this point that she is a lurker. The I Ching, I think, was maybe the most exciting one for me, but this one got me really excited too. The darker it is, the more excited I think I am.
Yeah.
Someone's like, it's just creepy. And I was like, that's why I
like
it.
I know. Like, yeah, that's great.
I know.
You're saying it like it's a bad thing.
But it's going to be like Career of Evil levels of creepiness.
I want super creepy.
But yeah, there's a lot of freaking out in my notifications on Twitter about this one.
I believe it.
But again, I just don't think that we can look at the details. I know that sounds like the opposite of what we normally do. This is one where I just don't think we can
dive too deep into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Should we get into the Q&A for this episode?
Yes. This one I really like.
All right. So the Q&A for this episode. Outside of Strike and Robin, which characters stand out for you?
Part of the thing I love about world building, which obviously I did in a very extreme way with the Potter series, but I also do with the Strike series, because, and in this case, the world building is, it's backstory and it's the other characters they know and meet along the way and who remain constant. So I think readers definitely like Shanka, who is one of Strike's oldest friends. And they've known each other since they were teenagers, and they have had very different life paths because Shanka's been out, in and out of prison for a long time. And I still haven't told everyone his real name, which I do actually know, but that's because I want it to come at a certain point in the series. I love Barclay. Barclay is the Scottish subcontractor who joins the agency sort of halfway through the series and so far. And I really like Barclay, and he's one of the few characters that I've ever created who is based on a living model. He's based on a Glaswegian friend of mine, and very similar sense of humour. And my Glaswegian friend is a very clever man who's got lots of pockets of strange knowledge. He's just one of those very bright people who know you trip over sort of certain subjects with him, and he knows a ridiculous amount about it. In this book, we get a new subcontractor, two new subcontractors, both of whom I really like and who will be staying. So that's Dev and Midge. So for the first time, Robin is no longer the only woman at the agency, which is fun. And then, of course, I have to mention Pat. So Pat is the office manager who arrived in Troubled Blood, and she's staying. And Pat has some pretty big stuff in this book. And I love her. I love writing this older woman who is, you know, was not born to be in this particular world, but she's become really quite invaluable to the agency by this time. So I love Pat.
I love that she talks about world building as being the backstory of all the characters, because that's what makes these books and characters so special, is that they're so wonderfully rich in detail and backstory.
It really makes the world feel lived in, like the whole world exists, not just the bit we're seeing.
We know there's so much more in her brain. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about each character she mentioned. So Shanker is the first one, and I love that she knows that people love Shanker, but more importantly, I was thrilled to learn that she not only knows his real name but has teased us with the fact that she has a special moment for it to be revealed. What could it be? It's so exciting.
I think it's going to be something completely unsuited to him, like Brandon, Travis.
Yeah, something that doesn't sound dangerous at all.
Yeah.
I also wonder, what is the moment? You know, what can it possibly be?
Whatever it is, it's going to be something that would not have earned him street cred, I feel like.
For some reason, I was operating under the assumption that everyone calls him Shanker, but that's Strike's name for him, right?
Yeah.
So what do other people call him? His name, I guess, but what is it?
I want to know. I'm excited that we might get to know.
Okay, let's do the next one. So the next one she mentions is Barclay.
Yes.
No surprise to me that she loves him, because I think he's written with a lot of love. She puts a lot of humor into him. He's funny and likable and very interesting that he's based on a friend. That's fun.
Yeah, I'm wondering if she can give me her Glaswegian's friend, his phone number. just to hang out, just platonically, just to be friends, because I want to be friends with Barclay. He's a fun guy.
Let's all just buy a round of drinks for all of us and the guy that Barclay is based off of.
Yeah.
He sounds great.
Absolutely.
Next, she talks about Dev and Midge. This is the answer where we learned that these two are permanent, right?
Yeah. I'm really excited that they'll be around for presumably the rest of the books. At this point, it feels like their team has really come together. It's a solid group of competent detectives. It gels. And it feels like now we're entering a new era where the agency is is formed, and we can start enjoying all these people's dynamics with each other and all the insights into their characters and backstories and get to know them better.
This is the agency success era.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
I love that.
We're a success. Oh, I love that part.
They're the best detective agency in London.
I just thought about the fact that both of their names are on the door again.
Oh, god damn it. I can't think about that or I'll just get derailed completely.
I'm just thinking about that in the TV show because I feel like it's going to hit even harder once you actually see it. Strike an Ellicott detective agency.
Oh, that would be cute if it's like the last shot. It just kind of like pans out on the door.
Oh my god. I will lose my mind. Please and thank you. It needs to be a thing.
And then the last one she talks about, we saved the best for last, Joe saves the best for last, is Pat's.
Yes.
I love that she loves Pat as much as it seems we do. Probably more than we do, right?
Yeah. I mean, that would be difficult because words cannot express the strength of my undying devotion to Pat. Like, she is my queen. I love her a lot.
Me too.
If Joe loves her more than me, that's impressive.
I think she must.
I love Pat in the books and I love Pat in the TV series too.
She's hilarious in the series.
She's perfect. She's so funny. Absolutely perfect.
Yeah, she's really good.
I can't wait to see how that dynamic kind of blossoms between them.
Yes.
Because they were so good together in Troubled Blood.
Oh,
it's going to be amazing. Really good. Thank you, Pat. It's my favorite.
Oh, I love that when he points at her.
Know,
oh my god.
So funny.
All right. Let's get started with chapter 68.
Yes.
So in chapter 68, Robin visits Zoe and Strike also listens to Robin's interview with Pez Pierce.
So the epigraph to this chapter: the jealous doubt, the burning pain that rack the lover's heart and brain, the fear that will not own it fear, the hope that cannot disappear. That's from Letitia Elizabeth Landon's The Troubadour, Canto 2.
So this one is most obviously about Strike's jealousy about Robin kissing Pez and the other thoughts and feelings that this stirs up, right?
Definitely. And it's my favorite thing about this chapter. That last line, the hope that cannot disappear, is so good when you apply it to Strike because that's really been him throughout this book. He's afraid to bring up the Ritz because he doesn't want to be told a final no and diminish that hope that he's always had for something more.
Yeah.
If this chapter with Strike being so jealous is as good as it is, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
The Running Grave is going to be so good. It's going to be so good.
Yeah.
But I think that we also have to apply this to the other couple, although I hate using that word, because Robin overhears the argument between Zoe and Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile. And I could see this being applied to Zoe with her burning pain and her hope for a relationship.
Yep, I agree. Honestly, that interpretation is spot on. I don't have anything to add to it. I love it. Chef's kiss. I can't wait to get to Jealous Strike.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I feel so bad for Strike here at the beginning of this chapter because the universe really seems to be conspiring against poor Strike getting a pint of beer.
It made me laugh a bit that the Tottenham is atypically full because I'm guessing that it has more than once been that way because of Strike fans showing up en masse in real life.
Is Strike colliding with Strike fans? Because that sounds like his worst nightmare.
That makes me think of the TV adaptation of Career of Evil, where Kelsey was on the Strike fan boards. Had the little banner with the hearts on it.
Yeah.
Oh, that was amazing.
It also makes me think of in Lethal White when...
Oh, she wants his autograph?
When she wants his autograph. Yeah, or no, she wants really a selfie. Cute. She wants a selfie at first.
While he may have had difficulty getting a pint, at least he got to chat with Fiendy about football, though.
Yeah. I find it very entertaining that he's offended that Robin didn't choose Arsenal as Buffy Paws' team. It's like, where is your loyalty, Robin? Because I feel like her brothers would also be offended that she chose Man U, because Manchester is in Lancashire, and Lancashire and Yorkshire are bitter rivals. I googled this actually to make sure I wasn't inventing things, and I was right. The teams and counties have a rivalry that goes back to the War of the Roses. So I feel like Robin's brothers would also be on her case for being a football traitor.
There's a part in this book that says something like Robin cared almost nothing at all for football or something. It just made me laugh because I know the feeling, Robin. Yeah. She probably doesn't even think or care about that at all.
I am the exact same way. I don't care a single jot. I would probably also pick Man U because it's the most famous team.
Is Richmond a team? That's all I got. I know Richmond and Arsenal now.
I literally only support Arsenal because Strike says he likes that team. And I like, oh, we'll keep up with Arsenal just because it's like, oh, yeah, he'll be happy that won today.
There was a recent episode of Ted Lasso where Richmond played Arsenal. And I was like, I don't know who to root for. Very conflicted.
Friends, I admire your dedication because not even my love for Strike could get me to follow football in any capacity.
I literally have an Arsenal keychain on my car ring.
That's so risky because what if people think you like football and start talking to you about it?
You use it as an opportunity to bring up Strike.
Sound like a bit of a nutcase.
I like this football team because a fictional character I'm in love with likes them.
Why not just have a keychain of the fictional character? Because that's not how it works, okay?
I'm trying to go stealth here.
Subtlety.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to have to throw in like a Doombar keychain in order to really round it out to really make sure that I attract in the real weirdos because then they'll actually know what I'm referring to.
I would love to be spotted out in the wild by like another Strike fan. You know, like if I'm wearing my Strike shirt or something, just someone be like, hey.
I love your shirt.
Yeah. If anyone has any stories about meeting a Strike fan in the wild, like not from the internet, not someone you already know, I would love to hear it because that would be a lot of fun. It would be so exciting. It
would be.
We're normal, again, normal people.
So next, Netley calls Strike with an update on Kay and Evan. But before I get into that, I just wanted to say that Strike thinking that the choice of Nutley to rule Kea out had been largely dictated by his desire to keep the man out of his own vicinity makes me laugh a lot.
He put the most annoying subcontractor for the most annoying suspect.
I can't say I blame him because this conversation is just reinforcing how fucking annoying Nutley is. Good God.
Yes. His need for constant validation when he's not even good is exhausting.
J.K. Rowling is just so good at writing people. Because I feel like every character, even the smaller ones like Nutley, are so believable. Do you know what I mean? I feel like everyone has known a Nutley. I can think of a couple people I've worked with who remind me of this guy.
Yes, everyone does know a Nutley. Have you fed and watered your Nutley today?
Have you complimented your Nutley today?
But no, I agree. I have never read an author better than J.K. Rowling at making you feel things about characters. The full spectrum, hatred to adoration, it is more intense than any other author.
Yeah.
Is there a character that one loves more than like Cormoran or Robin or Harry? And this from the woman who wrote Umbridge, the
most hated,
most rage-inducing, if I could pick a fictional character to stab in the face. Umbridge. All I'm saying is that J.K. Rowling is a talent.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Next, we hear Netley describing Kea taking a call while out with some friends, and we're going to go over some key points. So the first one is that she's upset with the person she's calling for not calling her sooner because she needs to get a message to Josh.
Who is she actually talking to here? Did we ever figure that out?
I thought it was Inigo, but maybe I'm mixing that up with another phone call. Mm. It's hard to keep track.
Inigo would make sense, though, because he could be the line to Josh.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
And then the next one is that there are rumors going around about Kea on Reddit, which she claims aren't true, and that she thinks are posted by Anime.
You know what's so funny about this is that it seems like Strike is annoyed that Netley doesn't know what Reddit is, because he keeps calling it Edit. Mm-hmm. Maybe not annoyed, but he keeps correcting Netley a bit. And I was just wondering how long Strike has known what Reddit is, you know?
Right? He does not seem like a Redditor.
No.
I wish that I didn't know what Reddit was. I wish I could live in blissful ignorance.
Yeah, I don't actually use Reddit that much. I think I've maybe left a total of 2 or 3 comments ever. Mm-hmm. But usually my reaction is one of dread when Ken sends a link to something because I'm like, oh no, what is this going to be?
Yeah.
It's usually something terrible.
After his phone call with Netley, Strike turns back to Drek's game and shortly thereafter receives a text from Prudence, which he delays responding to.
I know that everyone has probably at one point or another not responded right away to a text, right? But I was still like, come on, Strike, because I'm just so eager for them to meet. I wanted him to respond to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because Joe, she's been teasing us all throughout the novel by bringing this up and not letting it happen. I'm expecting a huge payoff for this in The Running Grave. I really am.
Yeah. I think also the fact that she told us that we're right to like her makes the anticipation even sweeter.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm so glad that you said something to her about that. And that we know now that we're right to like her. That's great.
Me too.
Speaking of so good, Robin then calls Strike after she leaves her drinks with Puzz. And she says that she sent Strike the recording of the interview and is heading over to Junction Road.
This is one of the points in the book where I remember exactly what I was thinking the first time I read this book. When she says, "I'm sending you the recording," I literally could not have been happier. I was so excited for Strike to listen to that. It does not disappoint.
No, yeah.
I was so excited. I remember texting Ken's like, "Oh my gosh," she was ahead of me.
And I'm over here trying not to react to anything that you're saying. It's so hard because, like, I don't want to ruin it for you, but like, oh my God, you don't even know.
Yeah.
Switching back to Robin's point of view, Robin's feeling a bit flustered after her time spent interviewing and kissing Pez. And it says, Robin was prepared to do a lot for the Strike Detective Agency and had an 8-inch long scar on her forearm to prove it. But she didn't think sleeping with Pez Pierce lay within the scope of duties Strike could reasonably expect of her, even if spending the night with him might have enabled them to rule him out as enemy.
Always makes me laugh that she would ever think that Strike would expect that.
It is quite literally the opposite of what Strike would ever want.
Yeah. I know she doesn't mean it, but, you know, it's just funny.
Yeah.
Robin then reflects on the differing reactions to rejection from the various men in her life.
What do you think it means that she doesn't think about Strike here?
I feel like maybe it's because in her heart, she's not really rejecting him. So it doesn't count, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too. It wasn't a final rejection. It was just a, not now, I'm scared.
So it doesn't count.
Oh, but he thinks, okay.
I know, he doesn't know that. He will one day, don't worry.
That's what I can't wait for, is for them to know. When they finally know the other person feels this way. It's going to be so good. The payoff is going to be
amazing.
Yeah.
I might go back to smoking just to have a cigarette after it. I might have to.
A celebratory cigarette.
It might be necessary.
I really love this paragraph where Robin describes herself basically having a bit of a sexual awakening after her encounter with Pez, when it says, however, while his tongue had been probing the deepest recesses of her mouth and his hands caressing her back, her body, which had foregone any form of sexual contact for 3 years, hadn't much cared what her brain was up to. The slightly uncomfortable truth was that her physical response to Pez hadn't been entirely feigned. Robin wasn't sure whether she felt more abashed or proud because Pez Pierce, a man with, she suspected, an extensive sexual history, didn't seem to have detected anything in her responses that gave away a lack of experience. I had always kind of hoped she would have this with Strike, but you know what? Good for her. She still got it.
Yeah, good for her.
There's a line just in a bit where Strike thinks he thought what? That she was some innocent schoolgirl. And that's really interesting to me because we have not seen Robin really being sexual or even flirty in these books at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, we see her have sex with Matthew and Lethal White, but she's so miserable that she cries. She didn't desire that intimacy with Matthew. And I think that's what J.K. Rowling meant when she said we're going to see a different side of Robin that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we get to see a lot more of this side of her.
I think that maybe Robin has kind of lost touch with that side of herself. And so someone showing any sexual interest in her, and that line from Troubled Blood where she said she had been missing touch. So Pez is definitely touching her.
Sure is.
I just think this is maybe a spark from her that we might get more of.
Yeah, I agree. And it makes sense to me that Pez's touch causes this reaction. Because like when you're touch starved, a little touch, it feels like a lot in a good way. It's impactful.
Yeah. I said in our last episode that I thought this was important for Robin. And the reason why I feel that way is because, yes, I want to see her have sexual feelings and thoughts for Strike. But Robin is insecure about this when it comes to Strike. We know that from what she tells Ilsa. If she can realize that this part of her is still there, and she doesn't need to feel insecure, that's going to be a really good thing for them going forward.
Yeah, I agree. It goes back to that experience thing. I don't think she needs to sleep with a bunch of men to be like ready to be with Strike, you know, that old argument.
Yeah.
What I would love is to see her feel confident and like she's on an equal footing with him sexually. But she doesn't need to sleep with a bunch of men. She just needs to, like you said, get
it with herself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, exactly. It's not about experience, but her realizing she's capable of being confident.
Yeah.
And I think kissing Pez and feeling confident, feeling some physical reactions because of it, if that all means that she'll realize that she has confidence within her, that's why I think it's an important moment for her.
Yeah.
That's why I think this is great for her.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm still not sure what I think is going to happen with Murphy, because sex is a bigger deal to her than it is to Strike. Meaning there's no question if Strike is going to sleep with someone that he's seeing, right? Like there is with
the
Robin.
The sleeping comes before the seeing for him.
Yeah, really. I know. But I trust that whatever happens will all go to benefit Strike and Robin's relationship in the long run. Like I trust Joe on that. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I do too.
And oh God, it just makes me wonder, thinking about Strike, it makes me wonder how sex will be for Strike with Robin, because like I said, it's never been a big deal, but he's never already been in love with someone first. I really hope we get to see his thoughts and emotions about that and how it's different.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I really, really hope so. Because, oh my gosh.
That'd be very sweet.
He's never been in love with someone first before.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I'm having some emotions now. I'm going to go off to my emotion room.
An emotion room?
Yeah, it's like a pad of bunch of pillows so I can just curl up and feel the emotions. You know, just when you feel too much about Strike, you just go curl up and lie down in the little emotion closet.
Just lie down.
I'm sorry. You're calling kids ridiculous for having an Arsenal keychain. You want an emotion room for Strike feeling.
If I'm feeling stuff, I'm just going to go curl up in the emotion closet. I think that's normal.
It went from a room to a closet.
Well, it feels cozier, you know? And then I can feel like I'm Harry Potter.
Oh, boy.
I think our listeners will understand. You get it, guys, right? Like the emotion closet? Y'all know what I'm talking about.
All right. Of course, her thinking about her lack of experience leads her into thinking about what happened at the Ritz and about her experience with Strike.
And that's really the best part about it, isn't it? Because all of this is making her think about Strike, because that's the man who she's really worried about, thinking that she's not experienced.
And you know what? Part of me wonders if she was thinking about Strike during this little snogging session as well.
Maybe. I have to imagine that at some point in the running grave that she's going to be thinking about Strike when she's with Murphy.
Oh my God, I hope so.
Kind of how she was always comparing how she felt with Strike versus with Matthew in Lethal White. You know,
She didn't want to think about it.
Next, Robin visits Zoe's house as Jessica Robbins to check in on her since she wasn't at North Grove. And Robin's intuition kicks in here when she sees the person in Zoe's window and then after some time manages to find a way inside.
It's great to see Robin acting on these little waves of intuition the way Strike does.
Yes. Even these little moments prove that she's now fully realized as a detective, just like her partner.
They're so good together.
But also note that we have another instance of a communal doorway being poor security here, because that's how she gets in. Some guy lets her in. So we've got a little bit of foreshadowing for the very upsetting murder that happens with the communal doorway later.
Now, we don't see who it is at first, but we learned that it was Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, that Zoe is arguing with in her flat. And there are a few things of note that are mentioned here, being put in a hell of a position, and then there's mentions of threat and blackmail and quote-unquote taking the risk.
I hate him so goddamn much. You started this, asshole. I know everyone knows that a grown-ass adult who wasn't a pedophile would never let a situation with a child even get to where something is going to be started. Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, gaslighter, groomer, garbage man.
It's the three G's.
Three G's. Now that I've got that out, what is it that we think Zoe wants from Ashcroft the pedophile here? Does she just want their relationship out in the open, relationship with a big double quote there, out in the open? Do we find this out?
I think you're right that she wants their relationship out in the open. We know that in the beginning of the book, she was wanting to go to the pub with all of them. And she made that comment that people won't have to know. So I'm assuming that that's what she's pushing for.
Yeah, she doesn't want to feel like his like little secret.
After Robin finishes making notes about what she heard, we switch back to Strike, who's taken about 2 pages worth of notes on the interview with Pez. And of course, the parts of the interview that he's particularly interested in are the ones where she's kissing Pez.
I love this because normally what he's particularly interested in these recordings is the case stuff. We've seen him rewind a recording before in Cuckoo's Calling when he was listening to Tansy Vestigli's interview. He rewinds it to listen to the part where she describes Little Falling. But the fact that here, the work is second in interest to Robin's feelings and actions is significant to me.
Oh, yeah. It's like he doesn't even register any case stuff at all.
Yeah, he's like, case stuff? His 2 pages of notes are, is she kissing it? What can I hear?
What does it mean?
Where are their tongues? Where are his hands?
I need some limb continuity here.
Can I get CCTV from this pub?
It's funny because he knew that their goal was to get Pez to ask her out. But I don't think he ever thought that this would happen.
No.
And to be fair, I didn't really expect this guy to be all over her like this for agreeing to one drink with him.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
But yeah, again, I could not contain my excitement during this part where he was listening. I was squirming in my seat. I was so excited. It was amazing.
So Strike gets to Robin's alternates to the NHS line, and he thinks he'd never heard Robin talk like that, never imagined she could flirt that well. He thought, what, that she was some innocent schoolgirl? I was just thinking, is she really flirting that well, or is he just really taken by her flirting here because he's already crazy about her? Because it doesn't come across to me like particularly impressive flirting.
Oh, I thought it was. Yeah, I thought it was good. It's clever and suggestive and so very different from how he's ever heard her speak before. Yeah, I think she's flirting well. I think it's pretty good.
I thought it was good flirting too. But this just makes me think that, oh my God, I need to see her flirt with Strike. Okay. I need to see her flirt with Strike and flirt with each other. I might literally spontaneously combust when that happens.
Oh, God. Yeah. Reading words of them flirting will be like looking directly into the sun. I will need to read it through my fingers to be safe from spontaneous combustion.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah. And I do often. Remember how much we wanted Flirty Strike in Ink Black Heart?
Yeah, we sure did.
Oh, very wrong about that.
So wrong.
One day, maybe we'll get Flirty Strike and Robin.
Maybe in the last 10 pages of The Running Grave, we'll get a little flirt.
That'd be amazing.
All right, so this next bit that I'm going to read just honestly drives me insane because these two need to talk about what the real reason was for Robin's rejection of Strike in the next book, or I am just going to lose my mind. Strike had told himself there were good reasons she might have been panicked by his ill-advised approach outside the Ritz, but now he learned that she was perfectly prepared to accept a sexual overture if it advanced a case. Or, perhaps, if it was made by a muscular young artist whom, apparently, she'd already seen naked.
He picked up on that, eh?
This is where the line about hope from the epigraph comes into play for me, so the hope that cannot disappear. Because he's trying to find ways to hold on to hope that she wasn't rejecting him. But he's also showing a bit of his own insecurity here. Mm-hmm. We focus a lot on Robin's insecurity of being inexperienced, but I really do love that both of them are feeling this a little bit. I don't like that Strike is worried that she might find him repulsive. I've said that before, but I think signs of insecurity in him are signs that point to his true feelings. Because we've never seen him be insecure with women before. Because there isn't any real weight to those relationships.
Yeah, that is exactly it. And that's why I kind of love him feeling insecure so much, because it is a sign of how important she is to him and how deep his feelings for her are.
Because a real rejection, a final rejection, would hurt him a lot.
Aww.
He's going to be feeling that in The Running Grave, I think.
Oh,
I just can't wait for him to realize that he's wrong. Aww. And for Robin to realize that she's wrong. I can't wait.
They're going to be so happy. They're going to be like stupid smiles.
That's going to be how I'm going to look when I read it.
Yeah, I'm going to have a really dumb expression on my face for the good 48 hours afterwards. Yeah.
Only 48 hours?
It's going to be stuck there for a long time.
But I guess I also really like it because going back to that sort of male reactions to rejection thing, I feel like so often the very male pattern response is to say that there's something wrong with the person rejecting you, like you jacks who call a woman a bitch for saying no. I think that women, on the other hand, tend to internalize rejection a lot more, saying, oh, there must be something wrong with me. And I'm not saying that all men or all women react this way, or that there's not a blend of things. But I suppose what I'm really getting at is that using rejection to do some internal reflection, to take a look at yourself and your situation and figure out what's going on here rather than blaming it on out there. I kind of like that response is all.
Do you think that that's what Strike is doing yet? Because it seems like he's worried about the wrong things to me. His age, yes. His attractiveness. When those things are not the issue to Robin at all.
He's not yet reached the point where he's reflected on the real issue, which is his attitude towards independence and, you know, commitment.
Yeah, they really do need to talk about it. I wouldn't be surprised if they fought about it, to be honest. Oh,
I would love a good fight. Not gonna lie. Yes. We need some yelling about feelings up in here.
Please and thank you.
I would too, because their fights are always very successful at resulting in change.
Yeah, they are.
We've seen that a lot. And they might be more likely to say what they actually mean if they're arguing and in the heat of the moment.
Yeah.
Before we start the next chapter, I just have to point out one of the best things about this whole chapter is that it says that Strike scowled at the wall for 20 minutes when listening to that recording. It cracks me up. I love it so much.
That's a long time. Like, that is a full episode of some comedies.
Yeah. Are we ready for chapter 69?
All right. In chapter 69, Drex Game gets a new moderator and Anime blackmails Hartella.
So the epigraph, she served him meekly, anxiously, with love, half faith, half fear. And that's She Sat Alone Beside Her Hearth by Letitia Elizabeth Landon. I think this one is about Hartella and Anime. Mm-hmm. We see him tell her that she has to do it or take over for Anime. And she's doing it as this epigraph is describing, meekly, anxiously, half faith, half fear.
We have seen this particular poem before. It was just used in chapter 62 with Kia and Katya and their feelings for Josh. So that is a repeat in really close succession. But yeah, I agree with you that this is about Hartella doing Anime's bidding. Her love of the game and the fandom are being used against her by its creator, who has turned cruel, or, you know, has turned his cruelty on her. It's very straightforward. We've got a series of very straightforward epigraphs.
So as you might have guessed from our chapter summary here, we're back in Drex Game for another chat chapter. And there's one with Anime, Worm 28, Fiendy, Hartella, and Borkle Drek, who has just become a new mod. There's another one with Anime and Hartella, Fiendy and Worm 28, and then Fiendy and Hartella. So starting with the moderator group channel, we find out how this person scored on the test and who they guessed was Anime. And it's really interesting to me that Josh Blay's brother is a common guess for who Anime is, considering that we hear absolutely nothing about him in this entire book.
Why did they rule out his brother at some point? Or did they never?
I didn't even remember he had a brother. Let's be honest. I didn't either.
Interesting. But apart from that, in this bit, I love the info here that Fiendy scored an 83% on this moderator test because my girl is a real fan. It might just be my crazy talking, but I really love tests. And either it's insanely hard or Anime has a really low bar for his moderators to clear, because passing with less than 64%, which we know that Worm does, that's crazy to me. That's not a pass. You want a moderator who only knows, you know, 58% of the show? No.
Maybe it involves people that he feels like he can manipulate.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah. For me though, I see this differently because the percentage does not reflect the level of fanness for me, because I'm terrible at this kind of thing.
Oh,
even if it's something I know really well, I just don't do well on tests like this. Yeah. I always feel like a bad Strike and Robin fan if I take one of the Strike fans tests, even though I made one of them. I just don't do well. So I don't, you know.
Oh, interesting. I guess brains work differently.
Well, to be fair, some of those Strike fans quizzes are like
ridiculously hard.
Yeah. It's like, which pub did they go to on this particular date or whatever, where it's like you would have to have a memory like fucking Anna Kiara in order to remember what pub they went to at this particular point in the book.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I don't think that the scores really can reflect how much of a fan someone is.
Okay.
After some time, Gus's Paperwhite enters the moderator channel asking after Morehouse. This exchange between Borkle Drek and Paperwhite really reads differently when you know the twists. Like when Borkle Drek talks about how great the game is and Paperwhite's reaction, It just kind of gives me shivers because honestly, Gus must have been laughing to himself the whole time here.
Is that where Bartledreck calls Adamy a genius and Paperwhite said that he'd love to hear him say that?
Yep.
It's kind of weird that as Paperwhite, he kind of jokes about his own ego.
Yeah. I guess it really helps him to sell it that she, Paperwhite, is totally different, totally real person. But I can also believe that when he's doing this kind of stuff, he's testing people, trying to goad them into shit-talking Enemy so he can put them on, you know, whatever list he's got of people who have wronged him.
Yeah, I just wonder if some part of him is aware that he has an extreme ego.
I'm sure he does, but he thinks it's justified.
Well, you know, it's not arrogance if you can back it up, and I'm clearly the best.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this moderator chat, there's a little bit of a spat between Fiendy and Paperwhite here towards the end.
I think there's truth to what Paperwhite says, that Fiendy is mad at her because she's with Morehouse.
With air quotes there.
Yeah. Paperwhite, or Gus, is purposely putting a wedge between them, and I think Rachel can tell.
And Paperwhite framing it as pure sexual romantic jealousy as opposed to a more complex recognition of what Paperwhite has done to an important friendship in Fiendy's life and Fiendy's insight into what a shit stir she is.
So going on to the next chat, we're going to go over the chat between Enemy and Hartella. And Enemy starts this chat by immediately telling Hartella that she needs to do quote unquote it again. And by it, he means logging into the game and providing a false alibi for him. Hartella is upset here because she has a work presentation and doesn't really have the time to cover for Enemy.
Okay, I don't care what anyone says. I feel bad for her here. This is no longer just an online situation for her. And I get why she feels blackmailed into doing this. I guess I can just feel the secondhand stress of having a work presentation and then having this dumped on you. Sounds awful.
Yeah, I can, you know, I can feel bad for her here too. I'm not a monster. I can recognize this is, must be shitty.
Beep, beep, beep. Breaking news. Pools feels bad for Hartella.
Oh my God. Seriously, alert the presses.
Yeah.
And Enemy once again reinforces just how unhappy he is that Hartella spoke with a journalist, quote unquote, and threatens to turn her into the police for assisting the happening.
I feel like this should have stood out to me a bit more than it did on my first read because the epigraph, I think, is really speaking to this. But I didn't ever suspect that she was filling in for him.
Honestly, I didn't even stop to wonder what it was she was doing for him in my first read there. I would make a terrible detective.
All right, the next chat is between Fiendy and then Worm 28. And in this chat, Fiendy reaches out to Worm 28 because she's concerned that there's something up with Hartella. Worm thinks that there's something up with Hartella because she's sad that Lord Drek has left the game. And obviously, it seems like kind of an open secret that those two are pretty close.
Or so she thinks. It's probably partly true. She still doesn't know or realize that Lord Drek is who he is. Do we ever get her reaction to him being banned?
I don't think that we did, but I think the whole blackmail thing might be distracting her a bit from the LD drama. But also, at this point, has Yasmin already been snubbed by the actor at his play? Meaning that he had no idea who she was.
I don't know where we're at in the timeline with that, but I hate thinking about it because it's so awkward. Oh. I get so much secondhand embarrassment.
So cringe. Oh my God. Yes. Also, though, I just realized that Hartella has been quiet because she's been busy logged in as Enemy.
Yeah, there is that.
So maybe her being quiet is a clue to what she's doing.
As soon as Paperwhite joins the moderator chat, Fiendy immediately launches into shit talking about Paperwhite with Worm, who isn't having any of it. And I have to say, it's a bit callously phrased, but Fiendy's response to Worm saying Paperwhite is an okay person and then her reasoning for why does sort of ring true here. Just because Paperwhite offered a hollow platitude doesn't mean that they're necessarily a good person.
I guess it's a good way to confuse the reader at this point about opinions on Paperwhite.
Yeah, it could be. It supports my desire for Rachel and Zoe to be life friends, even though Worm storms off and Fiendy does the very relatable, oh, for fuck's sake.
I like that she types that after she's gone. Like, no one's going to see it.
But you know what? She had to get it out. And honestly, Rachel, relatable.
It needs to be on the record.
Yeah. I get it 100%.
Let the record state that I did not let that go unchallenged.
Yeah.
All right. And then lastly, we have the chat between Fiendy and Hartella. And since reaching out to Worm wasn't successful, Fiendy then reaches out to Hartella directly to see how she is, and then Hartella immediately deflects.
It's nice of Rachel to check on her, but it also goes to show that she can read the room. You know, she's more aware of what's going on than the others are, and she's picking up on the fact that something is off with Hartella.
Super sus.
Are you ready for chapter 70?
Yes. In chapter 70, the agency is sent a bomb. The epigraph for this chapter, "While I was fearing it, it came." And that is from 98 by Emily Dickinson. Really short, sweet, and to the point.
Yeah, I remember reading this and going, oh no, because I think I knew it was going to have to be something with the happening, because that's been the biggest fear Strike and Robin have had in recent chapters. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, it wasn't that bad, but I was nervous when I read this epigraph.
Oh, yeah. It's chilling, isn't it? Oh, my God.
Ominous as hell. This is what they've been fearing, and it's here. And your point, Lindsay, about it not turning out too bad. The poem itself says that the suspense of waiting for something bad to happen can be so much worse than the actual bad thing finally happening. And the chapter's end checks out with this poem, because they weren't hurt too badly. They got some shiny new redecorating out of it. This suspense was in a way worse than the bomb finally going off.
So the beginning of this chapter finds Strike in his own bed, having awoken because his stump keeps twitching.
He got less than 4 hours of sleep. Just thinking about that makes me tired. Especially thinking about the day that they have. No wonder he falls asleep so quickly later on Robin's bed. Sofa bed.
A little Freudian slip there, what we were all hoping. Yeah, not enough sleep.
And Robin only got 2.
I know, she's winning, losing. But with his twitching stump, the doctor later suggests that this might be because of stress. Do we think it's a coincidence that this started after he spent all evening listening to Robin kissing someone else?
I think not. No.
It's definitely not helping.
It did not help his stress levels having to listen to that. Mm-mm. But also, a small note regarding his lack of sleep. He says he was up until 1:30 making notes. No, he was up until about 1:10 making notes. And then he was up until 1:30 scowling at the wall.
Yeah.
Just to be clear about the timeline there, Strike.
Totally rational, normal reaction.
20 minutes. Could have had 20 minutes more sleep.
Well, since he can't get to sleep, he takes a shower and thinks about his health and the situation that he finds himself in. As his stump continued to jerk, he saw it as a mute appeal. Something had to change. And yet immediately after chastising himself while he was in the shower for smoking, proceeds to light up another cigarette. Strike, I love you to death, but I want to whack you with a wet newspaper sometimes.
He does go down to the office early so that he doesn't smoke more.
That is smart. That is a good coping strategy. But, you know, it sucks for him because the twitching is definitely, stress is contributing. But the thing is that stress makes you instantly crave a cigarette, which makes you unhealthier, which leads to worse leg, which makes more stress. And it is a vicious circle.
Yeah, this whole thing just sounds like me saying, I got to start my diet right after I eat this hamburger.
We all do it. He's hashtag relatable sometimes.
After drying himself off and drinking some tea, he realizes that he has a date with Madeline that night and thinks about his predicament with her. This next bit that I'm about to read is really interesting. I just love getting little glimpses into how other people have tried to talk to him about his approaches to relationships before. I just think that that's always really interesting. But it says, he'd been accused before now of subconsciously sabotaging relationships because he didn't really want commitment. He remembered being lectured by Ilsa on the need for compromise and forgiveness after splitting up with a short-term girlfriend whom he dated during one of his many breaks from Charlotte.
This kind of made me think of Lorelai's letter. Mm-hmm. But I like that Ilsa has done this too. I wonder why he doesn't seem as annoyed by Ilsa's meddling as he does with Lucy. Well, no, I take that back because it's very different with siblings, isn't it?
Yeah, it is definitely different. Way more annoying coming from siblings. I feel like Ilsa's probably better at getting her point across without annoying the shit out of him. Because, you know, she's a lawyer. She knows how to make an argument, nail someone down. Plus, whenever she's lecturing him, he's probably got Nick in a pint there as well. And I feel like that would make him a bit more tolerant.
Ilsa also doesn't come with the whole Leda argument in that history too.
Ilsa's less likely to derail into a very touchy area for him.
Yeah.
There's this next bit where he thinks, and he tried, hadn't he? He genuinely tried to give the relationship with Madeline a chance. The sex was good. There were things about her that he found endearing, even admirable, but there was no avoiding it anymore. Something essential was missing. Yeah, that she's not the woman you're already in love with, you big dummy.
I don't think he's ever thought about a relationship in those terms before, that something was missing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Almost like he's on the verge of a revelation.
By saying something's missing, he's acknowledging that a relationship in which nothing is missing is a possibility, right? He acknowledges the negative, which means that the positive must exist.
It means that he wants more, I think.
Yeah, he does. And we know who he wants it with.
Before we get to the stuff that Strike is researching, can we just talk about Jealous Strike again? Because he texts Robin to just come to the office, and she wants to come in a little late because she's been up all night, and that worries him.
Yeah, he does. His mind instantly shoots off to absolute worst case. But let's be real. He 100% pulled her off of surveillance just because he wanted to see her. Like, he wanted to, his excuse about Nutley having gotten stuff on Kia is nonsense. Nutley got fuck all. It was Strike who figured out the clue after this. He just wants Robin to be in his presence.
Yeah, he wants to see her and find out why she was up all night.
Yeah.
But I love this little parallel to all those times where Robin has worried or wondered where he spent the night.
Oh, yes, yes. How the turntables.
One of those things that we've talked about before where the two of them are sort of switching places or having that role reversal in this book.
Yeah. And it's such an important part of them coming to a place of true equality on every level, is that sort of role reversal.
Next, Strike heads downstairs to the office and resumes looking into some lines of inquiry, most of which don't really go anywhere except for the Reddit post about Kay and Niven on the horrific Track Criminal Bitches subreddit.
I like that this part seems like a little clue to me, where he's looking for any friends of Gus's and he can't find any, and then says that if he has any social media, he's using a pseudonym. It's another thing that feels like it should have pointed me to Gus, but didn't.
Add it to the pile. Really big pile.
Also, the fact that Gus doesn't appear to have any friends should have been a sign of a person who is really disconnected from real life.
Yeah, really. Also, this video of him playing the cello really well 7 years ago, he was already an accomplished musician then. So since, he's had plenty of time. And he's got plenty of time now to waste on the internet, because he can already play good.
Do people who play instruments at that level that Gus did really play and practice as much as Gus appears to? Is that normal? Does anyone know?
I have no idea.
I don't either.
I'm very not musical at all.
I thought that was a bit weird that they always thought that Gus was practicing that much or needed to practice that much, but maybe they do. I don't know.
I never got farther than When the Saints Come Marching In on piano.
Mine was Jolly Old Saint Nicholas.
Oh, nice. Oh, yep. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if he's going to university for it, I would assume that he would do a pretty good amount of practicing.
It just seemed like a lot to me.
But anyway, speaking of the horrifying subreddit that we were on, there's also a connection to Gus with the post about Darcy Olivia Barrett posted by the user with the John Baldwin handle.
This whole thing is so disturbing because I bet it's real.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like if you were to take a poll and ask a lot of women, we'd all have stories of how we could end up on a thread like this.
Yeah.
I had a guy who once pretended to our entire workplace that he was mad at me for ending a relationship with him that never existed, and or for rejecting him for another guy, which wasn't true either, and acting mad at me to keep it up at work every day. That was a whole traumatic thing with so much more to the story, but that part reminds me of this thread. Like, that would end up on there, and none of it is real.
That's horrific. I'm sorry that you had to experience that. But yeah, I think a lot of women would find this whole thing horribly familiar. You point out none of it was true? Yeah, none of the things on the subreddit are true. I'm guessing that guy's domestic abuse conviction was 100% deserved.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we know that Darcy, that allegation is entirely in Annamie's mind. I like Strike's sweet naivete. When he's surprised that the page hadn't been taken down, I'm like, oh, baby boy, sweet summer child, you have clearly never plumbed the depths of Reddit and the internet before, because the shit that's left up on there after report, it is unspeakable.
It is very sweet, especially because he's seen such terrible things. You know, I love that some things still surprise him with how awful it is.
New and more awful ways to hate women, right? So there's a user on Reddit that posted that Kaya threatened to kill Josh and Edie the night before they were killed, and that she deleted the tweets that prove that she did so. And thankfully, the deleted tweets are included. And we know that from Strike and Robin's interview with Josh, that this sequence of tweets all stems from Josh accidentally calling Kaya instead of Katya, right?
Yeah, which is a very dramatic reaction to a wrong number call. Very. I know it's because he said he was meeting Edie, but good Lord.
Yeah.
This line she writes, when you find out just how deep the betrayal goes. I'm like, girl, your ex is meeting up with his ex, and that's a betrayal?
Well, somehow? Of course, because it was her ideas that Edie stole, and now she's meeting her again. in the place where they stole it from her.
The drama, the absurdity.
Oh, she's so ridiculous. Good she Lord.
Really she is.
She needs a good therapist.
Yeah.
So this revelation about Kea's tweets causes Strike to go back and reference Kea's web history because he got a picture of it back when he was at her house, which then leads him to what we now know is Inigo's chronic illness support group website.
I love that this was planted so many chapters ago and now he's going back to look. It's paying off.
Yes.
Yeah. Can I just say how very on brand it is that the name of Inigo's website roughly translate to trials and pain?
Yeah, that sounds like him, but it also sounds like they're describing his personality.
Yeah, no kidding. And while he's scrolling through this website, he ends up getting to Inigo's Twitter feed, which we get to briefly read through.
Oh, lucky us. He would get an instant block from me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also notice in this thread, so he defends Kea and then Lapine's disciple has a go at him. That's father and son insulting and arguing with each other on Twitter without even knowing it. It's all very biblical. Or maybe Gus knows who his dad is on Twitter, but Inigo doesn't.
Yeah, if Gus is listening to conversations, I can see how maybe he'd know.
Yeah.
It must have felt satisfying for him to say horrible things to his father.
Oh, yeah, he probably loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of don't blame him for that.
Yeah, he can have a freebie for that one.
Our trawl through Inigo's Twitter feed is cut short by Pat running into the office and slamming the door shut right before a bomb goes off in the office. I'm so glad that Pat had the presence of mind to run and immediately put a barrier between herself and the hissing package, because that probably saved her life.
Yeah, we cannot have Pat dying on us.
Absolutely not. Unacceptable. I feel like Pat should win Employee of the Month every single month for like a year just for this, because she's fantastic.
Throw in a raise for Pat.
Pat deserves a raise.
Bombing yes. equals raise. I think that that's fair.
I think those are the rules of employment with the strike agency. Every time you're caught in mortal peril because of something the partners have done, you get a raise. Hazard pay. Hazard yeah. bonus. But I also like that Strike was up quickly enough to catch her when she got hit by the door, because mm-hmm. he does catch her. They both got pretty speedy reflexes.
And despite the fact that she literally almost just died, Pat is immediately on top of calmly calling the police and asking to get some help.
And Pat and Strike are very similar in their responses to what happens here. They're both very matter of fact while covering up that they're a little bit shaken.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they are. The way she describes this to the police is just fantastic to me. We've just been sent an explosive device and it's exploded. No miscommunication possible there. The bomb was sent. The bomb has blown up. Good job, Pat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Her ongoing preoccupation with getting her e-cigarette back in the next chapter is both endearing and hilarious.
Yeah, it's really funny.
The woman knows her priorities. Although I'd imagine that getting blown up would lead to a pretty strong need for nicotine.
Definitely.
I wonder if it's part of the shock too, just trying to focus on something else.
Yeah, focus on something small.
The first time that I read this, reading that the glass in the outer door to the office had been blown out just confirmed my already strong yes. suspicion that the glass was going to yeah. be replaced by the uh-huh. end with one of their
names.
We
knew it was coming.
Absolutely. I mean, in hindsight, I'm kind of happy this happened.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm like, thank you, bomb.
It is a visual representation of the Solvay et Coagula thing, isn't it?
Oh my God, mm-hmm. it so is.
Definitely.
And it got rid of that sofa too, which I'm happy about.
No more farting sofa.
No, RIP. I miss the sofa.
All right. Chapter 71. In chapter 71, Robin and Strike are interviewed by DCI Murphy and Neil Jameson.
So the epigraph reads, "These monsters set out in the open sun, of course they're monster shadows. Those who think awry will scarce act straightly." And that is, again, from Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
It's almost like that text is important.
Yeah, I think this is referring to the Havening, who attempted mm-hmm. their attack in broad daylight and mm-hmm. is rightfully referring to them as monsters.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. Their monstrous shadow has fallen over the office. But it's interesting to me that this bit in the poem is from Lady Waldemar, who's sort of like the Charlotte figure, talking to Aurora about Romney Leigh. She's saying that he's a monster because his heroic, godlike image is connected to a mortal man with mortal failings, i.e. he's about to marry Marion. And I was trying to connect this to the Strike as Romney parallel, but I couldn't really think of much. But could it be a clue about Murphy somehow? Like, this really nice guy image is connected to a man who has a mortal failing.
I think this is one of the times where it's maybe just about the Havening being monsters.
Yeah, okay. You're probably right. But the this might fuel the conspiracy fire about Murphy.
Are you saying that Ryan started the fire?
Ryan started the fire.
If anyone understands that, you are my people.
At the beginning of this chapter, we switch back over to Robin as she's heading back towards the office, and she receives a text from Strike with an update about the bomb sent to the office.
Before she gets the text, it says that she sees the police and the Tate blocking off the entrance to the office. I just think it's written so well because without actually saying she's feeling this sense of dread and panic, mm-hmm. you feel it start to creep up on her.
Yes.
And saying that her hands are shaking is such a good touch. Just to know that in those seconds, she was probably fearing the absolute worst.
Thank God it was over quickly.
I know. And also notice Robin runs across the street to get to the Starbucks.
Yeah.
And seeing Strike with blood on his collar and Pat looking pale is another moment where I wish she would have hugged him, because mm-hmm. I'm not sure if she would have done it in front of Pat, but you know that she was probably scared that something bad happened to him.
Yeah.
She's probably so relieved to see him there.
Okay, I will sign your petition because yes. And then maybe she could have pulled his collar away from his neck with her shaking fingers to make sure the wound wasn't too bad so she could examine it closely.
Mm-hmm.
Not like I'm imagining this.
No, not at all. I will sign that petition as well. I'm on board with that.
Back in the emotions closet.
Oh man, so this bit of bonding between Strike and Pat while Robin is off getting cigarettes and cigarette accessories is just perfect.
Sounds like King of the Hill.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Was that what you were going for?
You would get that. Yes, that's exactly what I was going for. I'm glad that you caught that.
Mm-hmm.
Him calling Pat a bloody marvel, that's typically only a compliment that's reserved for Robin. So this is high praise.
Pat is now the agency's second biggest asset. It's official. She got the compliment.
I love that he hits his plastic coffee mug against hers.
Aww, yeah.
It reminds me, he does this in Lethal White with Robin at the racetrack.
Aww. Yeah, that was really cute.
Pat getting emotional and Strike wanting to hug her, just... please let these two hug in the future. I am 100% here for these two being buddies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very sweet. This part is really showing how much they've grown to care about each other. You know, he's impressed by her, but also recognizes the signs of shock because he sees himself in her, and her being emotional over his gratitude and praise. So good.
Aww.
You know that bit in the first Harry Potter when they beat the troll? And it says that there are some things you can't go through without becoming friends.
Oh my gosh.
Even though I think Strike and Pat were already fond of each other, this feels like that, where this traumatic event only brings them closer together.
Oh my God. Don't make me cry. I love them so much. That's so cute. I want them to hang out outside of work to have some drinks, because I think that these two would have a blast once they loosened up a bit.
Yeah, I think so too.
So next, Pat opens up about her uncle dying in a pub bombing in the 70s, and she says, "Wrong place, wrong time. Hard to get your head around." "Well," said Pat with a glance towards the tabletop beneath which Strike's fake leg was hidden, "I don't need to tell you that."
First of all, I like that reference to his leg here. I don't really know why.
It is great. I feel like, I don't know, you might like it because she's being very matter of fact about it, acknowledging that this happened to him without being, you know, dramatic or offering too much pity. And it's exactly the kind of talk that he's comfortable with.
Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And like with many things in these books, this is a real thing that happened. I looked it up. A bomb was thrown through the window of the King's Arms in, how do you say it, Woolwich?
Woolwich.
Woolwich.
I don't know.
I'm sure somebody will correct us.
Yeah. On November 7th, 1974, it killed two people and injured 35 others.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah.
Incidentally, that is the month that Strike was born.
Yeah.
I'm not going to suggest that Strike might be the reincarnation of Pat's uncle. Because that would be a crazy thing.
It would be if you said that, yeah.
Yeah, it sure would be. That's why I'm not going to say it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay, so this may be a bit of a reach, but I think it's curious that Murphy's blue Toyota Avensis looks pretty similar to Strike's blue BMW if you squint. I wonder if that points more to the idea of Murphy being sort of like a Strike light sort of thing.
Yeah, maybe it's a stretch. I'm here for it, sure. We know it's being done in other ways, like with his hair. Although to me, it just looks like a car.
Yeah.
They all just kind of look like cars.
I too cannot tell apart the different types of car. But I was mostly concerned that both Ormond and Murphy had their car types so clearly stated. Parallels?
I mean, I hope that there are no parallels between Ormond and Murphy. I don't think they're going to be.
Yeah, I don't want that for Robin.
No,
he doesn't seem like the Dirty Harry type or the Dirty Harry wannabe type.
No, he seems chill.
I really sympathize with Pat not wanting to go to Scotland Yard to give a statement. I remember thinking about this after Robin is almost killed by Raph in Lethal White, that after all of that, she has to go give a statement. It just sounds horrible and exhausting. It's another sign of Murphy's good character, I think, that he also sees her shock and is okay with them giving statements in the Tottenham, because someone like Carver would never agree to that because he'd want to throw his authority around.
You're right. Yeah, this shows that he is insightful and he's chill, and I doubt that Scotland Yard has booze for visitors, so I feel like the Tottenham definitely gets an automatic win in the sort of statement giving venue contest.
Unless you're striking, you have it on you at the time.
Yeah, but I had a drink in this basement room of the Tottenham that they're going to.
Oh, fun.
I know, it was fun.
That must make it feel much more real.
Very real to me.
As a side note, Murphy's little oh hello to Robin is, I think it's cute. I know people don't want to hear me say that, but I mean, I'm not overly excited about Robin dating him, but I think I find it cute because I definitely imagine that he was secretly hoping to get to see her again. And that, oh, hello, is him being excited, but also an attempt to be casual about it.
Listen, I am right here with you. I think it's kind of cute too. Also, there's a bit later on in the chapter that I also find adorable. So can we put a pin in that? Because remind me.
I feel like I can hear the grumbling from the future when people listen to this, but I feel like it's safe to like these things because we all know that Strike and Robin are endgame and this is only going to bring them closer. So I'm embracing the plan.
Yes.
I feel like Joe's plan needs a TM, right? The plan TM.
The plan. It's inevitable.
Definitely.
Let's embrace the plan. We're all good. It's going to be good.
It's going to be great.
It says that Robin felt irrationally guilty for having not been there when the bomb went off. And I just find this so touching and so Robin.
Yeah, she is. She's such an angel sometimes. She's so sweet.
I think it's just part of being a team. You know, it shows the strength of their agency that she wishes that she could have been there during this awful thing. Maybe also because she feels guilty because she was the one who jumped on the train tracks and like maybe she feels like, oh, I should have been there.
Yeah, maybe.
Pat and Murphy have an exchange about the handwriting on the package they were sent. And I thought that this was interesting where Robin kind of is thinking about Murphy a little bit. And she thinks Pat always had a soft spot for handsome men. And Murphy was certainly good looking, as Robin, shaken though she was, now appreciated. High cheekbones and that full upper lip and wavy hair, somewhat like Strike's, though lighter in color.
I remember reading this and going, ugh. I really do hope that he's as nice as he seems, but I also can't wait for him to realize that Robin's in love with Strike, or however it happens.
Yeah.
I just really can't wait for the running grave.
I do like that Robin is taking a moment in this trying time to check this guy out. I'm like, yes, my girl, you can get it.
I also thought that it was interesting that she's noticing Pat's reaction to him. Because every time Pat has done this with men, she's misjudged them. I'm not saying that he's bad and that Pat is misjudging him, but I just like that Robin notices it because it's showing that she's still watching Pat.
I mean, eventually we'll have to have one handsome man who's not an asshole, right? Like, there's got to be some good looking guys out there who aren't assholes in the J.K. Rowling novels.
Of course.
Just because we haven't met one yet.
But it definitely makes sense that Robin is looking at him now because she didn't even register really what he looked like before.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh, who's this guy who asked me out? But as we've pointed out many times, there is that comparison to Strike's hair here.
Yeah.
And I love the connection that you made last time, Pools, with Strike dating someone with hair similar to Robin's and now this. It's also a little telling that Robin is already comparing him to Strike.
Oh my gosh. I feel like The Running Grave is going to be the book of how the turntables. And I am so excited for it. You have no idea.
You think we'll get something like, Robin found it convenient to be in a relationship right now.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? How he did?
Yes. The high-pitched noise I'll make when that happens is going to be magnificent.
I know.
It's going to be like only audible to dogs.
I wonder what chapters it's going to parallel, if she's going to do any chapter parallels, like kind of with, you know.
Yes, I know.
The two.
We need the book.
We do.
Okay. I'm calm.
They talk a bit about how the writing is not Nutter writing. Black ink, both Strike and Robin's names spelled correctly. Is it bad that my first thought was that, well, it's definitely not Oliver Peach?
Yeah. Now I have questions. I'm like, so do neo-Nazi organizations have sort of competent secretaries that they get to do the admin work, like sending bombs through the mail, making sure that they reach the right recipients?
Yeah, maybe Ryan Murphy knows.
Oh.
How do you make sure a bomb gets to the recipient?
I know. It seems like there would be logistics, right?
Yes. How do you make sure it doesn't go off beforehand? I don't understand.
I don't know. I guess it's the bomb maker's job. It's a complex thing to organize.
I like the way that Pat describes this when she says, I got one flap open and then I heard it hissing and I just knew. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the fact that they already were aware of the happening and kind of worried about this coming. But I'm having stressful thoughts of what would I have done? Would I have known?
Yeah, I don't even need to ask the question because I'm 100% certain that I would be evaporated by the bomb while staring at the package with a really stupid expression on my face.
It's hissing. Did someone send me a snake?
I would be excited. I'm like, did someone send me a snake? That's really exciting. I would not survive for long in these novels. It's amazing I've survived this long in the real world, to be honest. But then I haven't pissed off any neo-Nazis that I know of.
There's still tomorrow.
There's always tomorrow.
Yeah. Does Pat giving a statement remind anyone of Robin giving a statement when she received the leg in Career of Evil? Because the efficiency, the praise by the officers, it's just another thing that tells me what an asset Pat is, that she's so similar to Robin here.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. Yes. Yeah.
And she's behaving like Strike. She's like if Strike and Robin had a baby, an older baby who smokes like a chimney.
Maybe she is their child, time traveling back from the future to manage their agency. And Strike doesn't remind her of her ex-husband. He reminds her of her father.
Oh, dear God. I'm not even going to touch that. And we're just going to move on to our next point.
Sure. None of you appreciate my special skill.
You mean your absolute insanity? Oh, my God.
I do. Yes, actually, I do mean that.
Robin briefly leaves and then comes back with alcohol for Pat, and Strike's reaction to her not having any for him makes me laugh. And he says, you could have got me a pint while you were in there. I was bombed too, you know.
That was so cute and funny. Although I am reminded of that blog post that Louise Freeman did for us about Strike's past trauma and this stirring it up.
Mm.
I can't help but wonder if maybe he does need something.
My first response is also, oh, that's so funny. I wanted Robin to respond with something like, well, it's her first time being bombed. I feel like that's the kind of joke that Strike would laugh at or make himself. But on serious reflection, you know what? I think he does need something here, but he's not really taking care of himself or in tune with what he needs in this book, is he?
It seems like both Strike and Robin are so worried about Pat that neither of them think of Strike, you know? Mm-hmm. Or maybe he's just better at hiding it or realizing it, ignoring it.
Yeah, I think that's it. They're both so stressed, so concerned about all you've said, Pat, the continuing threat of the Havening, their office. Strike's trauma just doesn't register as another thing they need to worry about right now.
And of course it fits with him ignoring his needs in this book.
Sure does.
Did anyone else love this part where Murphy calls Strike Robin's boss and they both simultaneously correct him? Because it was amazing.
Yes, absolutely. I love that Strike does it at the same time, even more than Robin doing it, because he's not the one trying to show his status as a partner, right? He just wants Robin given that respect too.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite things about Strike in this book, that he's so unthreatened by Robin being his true equal.
Yes, not just him. It's one of my favorite things about him.
Ever.
Period. Yeah. It's a great character trait.
How do we feel about Murphy assuming that Strike is the boss? Because part of me was like, hey, but I guess it is his name on the door, so I can't really blame him that much.
I do like that he apologized and corrected himself right away, though.
Yeah, it was just the assumption that irritated me. But then again, the door.
Well, luckily, that's not going to be a problem for much longer.
Oh, I wonder if Robin's going to take a picture and send it to Ilsa.
Oh, she absolutely is. Yes.
Look what he did.
How cute.
And Ilsa's going to be like,
this man is in love with you.
Can you believe this, Nick? Can you believe them? I bet Ilsa rants to Nick about them all the time.
I know. Imagine how we are. I'm speaking of Ilsa like she's a real person, but it must drive her crazy.
She has to witness it. Yes. Yeah. Oh my God.
Captain Ilsa.
So Murphy asks what Robin's home situation is. And we know that some people find this suspicious, if you like the he's a bad guy theory. But he really does need to ask this.
Yeah. It's his job. This is the bit I was talking about earlier when I said another cute thing he says, because I really like the way he says in the middle of this, I don't mean to be personal, because he's aware that he asked her out and it didn't go great.
Yeah.
He doesn't want her to think that he's like prying or gearing up for another shot. He wants to make sure he's just being a good guy and doing his job.
And I also have to say that it really does feel like they're being set up to date, because we learn here that he lives right by her. And I remember thinking, of course you do.
Right.
So convenient.
Yeah.
Strike then insists on taking Pat home and he says, don't worry, it's not because I like you. Just don't think I could find another office manager with your skill set. And I know that I've said this a million times, but I love these two so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the second time that Pat's eyes start to water. It's everything that I had hoped for after Troubled Blood. And knowing that Joe has said that Pat has a couple of good moments makes me so excited for The Running Grave.
Me too.
Yeah.
I know we keep saying that. Can we say it more? Yes, we can. And yes, we will.
So something cute that happens in this chapter is Robin offering Strike the sofa bed at her place.
It's almost like we knew that would be useful.
I know.
And then here we are a couple chapters later, Chekhov's sofa making its return.
It does make me sad though when she says that she immediately wishes she hadn't said it and thinks that he would want to stay with Madeline instead.
If only she knew how little he wants to stay with Madeline and how much he really wants to be in Robin's bed, sofa bed. Mm-hmm. Robin's sofa bed.
Right. Maybe that's why when he calls her, it pleases her so much.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It says that Strike makes no response. And am I the only one wishing and hoping that the reason he didn't make any response is because he likes this idea a whole lot and doesn't want it to show?
Yeah, he was definitely just playing it cool.
What I wouldn't give for Strike not to play it cool.
I know.
God, these two.
They're going to kill me.
Yeah.
That's my prediction for The Running Grave. They'll finally finish me off.
To round off this chapter, Murphy then offers Robin a lift home.
It's obvious that Robin is a little reluctant, and I have to wonder if she would have said no had that reminder of Madeline's existence not just come to mind.
That is a good question. I don't know. I mean, we can understand her reluctance here. I mean, she's definitely worried it's going to be super awkward, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think there might be also a bit of a worry that he'll try again. And I don't think that she's decided yet that she'd be okay with that.
Yeah. Given her experience with rejection lately, I'd be anxious about getting in a car with a guy I'd reject too.
Okay, chapter 72.
And in chapter 72, we see Robin and Murphy discussing anime.
The epigraph, you face today, mark me not a woman who wants protection. As to a man, show manhood, speak out plainly, be precise with facts and dates. And that is Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. I thought that the first part of this really speaks to Robin not wanting protection. She tells Murphy that she's fine at home when he suggests going to stay with friends. But also the second part, I think it's about Murphy, because yes, he tells her the facts of the arrest that they're about to make. But I think this is more about the personal and him telling her about his divorce and alcoholism.
Yeah, for sure. I really feel this as Robin's general desire to be treated with respect as an equal, and maybe to have one experience with a guy who will just straight up express his interest and ask her out in a respectful way.
I don't know if I see this as her desire yet, because I don't think she's seeking this out with Murphy here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because he does those things that makes her agree and say, okay, this is something I'm going to say yes to, even though I think she's still reluctant.
Yeah, I think so.
So getting into this chapter, we pick right up where the previous chapter left off with Murphy driving Robin back to her flat.
I love that the first line is, why the hell had she said yes?
Of all the impulses in this book that Robin repressed, this is the one she just goes with saying yes to this? Robin, you got to work with us, okay?
Yeah. I do think it's because of Madeline. Maybe a little bit of wanting to make Strike jealous. Maybe a little bit of wanting to put herself out there because she's hurt because of Madeline. And it's probably safer to allow it with Murphy because it won't hurt her as much as Strike not wanting permanence. So she thinks.
Mm-hmm.
When Murphy mentions having heard about the Shacklewall Ripper in the press, it makes me wonder whether he's had a bit of a crush on her for a while or if it was only after they met.
I think the most likely scenario is that it was after they met, but having remembered the situation with the leg, maybe it made an even further impression on him.
Oh, I bet that's the case, because he'd definitely be aware of the agency. Jesse and Robin from both the news and from other cops.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if he knows Wardle, because I bet the Wardle has said some very nice things about Robin. Probably not, you know, PC things.
Yeah.
But nice.
The other scenario is that he's lying, that he remembered reading it. And the real truth is that he Googled her after they met, which I kind of think is likely.
Oh, that's a good point. I'm sure that he did Google her before he called to ask her out. But maybe he's not lying and he did have sort of a vague memory about the leg thing.
Maybe.
It's something that sticks in the memory.
A leg being sent in the mail. Yeah.
Just a couple years ago.
I'd remember it.
Mm-hmm.
When Murphy talks about his sister in San Sebastian and him wondering why he lives in London, it just reminds me of so many of those tweets from the contest that Joe did on Twitter with the predictions that were basically suggesting that Murphy join Interpol and fuck off to San Sebastian. It was really funny.
Yeah, that was really funny. I had a look at some pictures. I Googled it and it's really pretty.
Yeah, I did the same thing. Listen, I'm not a beach person. But even I can see that it's absolutely gorgeous there. But so I think a couple of people have wondered if there are any clues to be found in Murphy's connection to Saint Sebastian via his sister's town, right? Because Saint Sebastian was a martyr. He was a saint who protected against the plague in the medieval period. He's the patron saint of archers and athletes.
Have you seen theories?
No, no real ones. Maybe he'll be martyred somehow.
Okay.
Just an interesting thing to keep in mind when we read about him in The Running Grave. It's going to be so anticlimactic if we get to the book and they went on one date and they weren't feeling it. And he doesn't even appear in the book.
Who just said that to me recently? I think it was Kurt who was like, what if she's trolling us with this and they only on the one date?
Oh,
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. It would be funny.
Mm-hmm.
So bless them. This conversation between Murphy and Robin before they start talking about the anime case feels so awkward and stiff to me. Like the conversation only ever seems to really flow well when they're talking about work stuff, which does make me wonder if this is a dynamic that's going to continue.
Oh, that's interesting. I think part of the reason is because Robin, who is so much like Shrike, is always thinking of the case first. You know, she puts aside any awkwardness she's feeling so she can try and get information out of him. It's actually a little funny.
It really is. She has a one-track mind. Two tracks. The other track is Strike.
Right.
But, you know, at least their conversation later is easier. I think they really just needed work to break the ice. It's a bit relatable. I really relate to her being like, I gotta think of something to say. I gotta think of something to say. And then nothing appears. Bless Murphy for keeping it going.
Right.
He's doing all the heavy lifting in this early part. He really is.
Murphy mentions that the Met thinks they know who killed Edie, but he can't say who. But we know that this is Philip Ormond. And what it says here is, in his place, she'd have felt the same temptation. She, too, knew the satisfaction of laying out pieces of the puzzle for somebody who appreciated what it had taken to get there.
This makes me slightly jealous on Strike's behalf, because we know the person who is usually appreciating her laying out pieces of a puzzle is Strike.
Listen, Strike can excuse her dating another guy, but he draws the line talking about murder with another man. You know what? That's when you find out how deep the betrayal goes.
Talking about murder with another man. Oh, no.
Raid.
No, I mean, I know you're joking, but I wonder if that will come up at all, because it's such a connection that they have.
I feel like it might.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited to see if it does.
But it's an interesting question that you had there, Kenz, about wondering about the dynamic between Robin and Murphy, because you'd think that Robin will bond with Murphy over being detectives, but I also expect there to be something missing in those moments, kind of just how Strike had just said that he thought there was something missing.
Honestly, that seems probable to me, because Murphy might be a decent detective, but I think that Robin and Strike just have this sort of intellectual compatibility that you can't replicate. They just click on that level, you know?
Yeah, I think we see that later with Strike and Robin's feelings about Ormond getting arrested. Yes,
exactly. Yeah.
Also, speaking of the phone's movements, so what Murphy's telling Robin about, it's odd that the person who has the phone, Ormond, keeps going to really busy places to turn the phone on and then off again. And Murphy points out that this is odd and a risky thing to do. Obviously, we know now that it's because Ormond is trying to get the Ink Black Heart ideas off of her phone. How desperate do you have to be to cash in on the Ink Black Heart, to risk having a murder pinned on you?
You know what? In a novel that's full of really horrible men, we kind of risk Ormond getting like lost in the noise. So let's take a moment of silent reflection to recognize what a shitty, awful guy Ormond actually is. Because holy God, he is real, real awful.
You're right. I mean, it's such an awful thing to do. He's tampering with evidence in order to cash in on the Inkblack Heart.
Ugh.
He must really not care about Edie or getting her justice.
Nope. I mean, he was already strangling her, so odds are he would have killed her himself eventually. Literally, the odds go up like 700% once a guy strangles you. So he's a real shithead. No, he doesn't care about Edie at all.
They get to talking about Ormond's Ford Fiesta that they noticed in the CCTV footage. And here's that part where I was mentioning a few episodes back about Robin lying to Murphy about how she remembered the license plate.
Mm.
First, I love the way that she surprises Murphy with knowing about the license plate.
Right?
So good.
He's so impressed by her detective memory and her knowledge. And she's just out here pretending it's not something she noticed solely because she's madly in love with her business partner. Yeah.
No, of course not. That might kill Murphy's buzz to learn that one.
he might find that less exciting.
Yeah. I know we all knew Ormond couldn't be the killer, but the fact that Josh's phone is still missing, that's pointed out so clearly, is a sign that someone else, the real killer, has Josh's phone. I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's an actual clue alongside the sort of meta clue of, well, the police have arrested someone, right. So it's definitely not them.
I also love that Robin felt this sense of anticlimax at learning they think it's Ormond, because it tells me that her instincts about him are right, you know, that it's not him.
Exactly. Here's another instance of Murphy sort of being impressed by Robin, because he mentions that she was the one who spotted the bruising on Edie's neck, and she was. Mm-hmm.
Interesting that he remembers that too.
He was paying attention.
I bet he was.
Yeah, he was. After they finish discussing the case, conversation turns personal and Robin brings up the elephant in the room, aka Murphy's failed first attempt at asking her out.
I do like the line that says, at no time did he mention his previous invitation for a drink, nor did he make her feel uncomfortable in this small space. And she was grateful for both these things.
This makes me kind of like him. And you know, Strike did the same thing, not talking about it.
Yeah.
If she had to choose one guy to bring up the elephant in the room with, you kind of wish it would have been Strike, right? But
of course.
Yeah, I guess it's easier for her to do it with the guy she's not invested in.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe this is like a trial run for her bringing up elephants in the room.
There
a little
we go.
Practice go before she tackles the big one.
It kind of makes me wonder if she's going to be the one to bring it up. Because he wants to do it at the end of Inkblack Heart, but I think that maybe Murphy's presence is going to quiet him down, just like Madeline's did for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God, how many times a day am I thinking about how they're going to get together?
We're almost in the double digits now until TRG.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think the how many times is well over triple digits for you.
Yeah.
In regards to your question.
For sure.
But also, can I mention how much I like the Robin astounded by her own bravery bit? You go, girl. I'm so proud.
Yeah. I would love to see her be brave with someone else in the future. Mm-hmm. You know,
all it takes Robin. 10 seconds of insane bravery.
Well, I'm not rooting for these two. Murphy's response of how is that possible when Robin says she's not used to people asking her out is really sweet.
It is really sweet. And I really love this line because it's another thing that tells me just how beautiful Robin must be and how impressive he finds her just in general.
Mm-hmm. And we're all the chorus over here like, how is it possible? Look at her. Look at her. I guess she's used to being harassed by her own employees and she's used to the sort of cone of emotional silence that she and Strike have going on and used to the general creepiness of every guy in her orbit. Is Murphy the only like normal, straightforward man she knows?
I don't know. I think it's possible that Robin has shut herself off from opportunities a bit because she's, you know, in love with Strike.
Yeah.
She's been hoping for it, even though she's only just recently admitted it to herself. Mm-hmm. We know that in Troubled Blood, she avoids seeing Vanessa and Ilsa because she doesn't want to talk about relationships.
Yeah.
I definitely think that she's done this a little bit too, where she shut herself off.
That makes sense.
Again, I'm just really, really interested to see if there are parallels with Strike when Robin dates someone in the Running Grave. I think it's going to be so good.
How many times can we mention?
Not enough.
Murphy mentions that he's also divorced. I have to wonder, was his alcoholism the main reason for the divorce? Like, how much did her not wanting kids factor into it? And was it the fact that she didn't want kids, period, or that she didn't want kids with him?
Well, he mentions he's been divorced for 3 years and he's been sober for 2 years, 9 months. So I'm guessing that the alcoholism did play a pretty big role.
There have also been some people that have been wondering whether or not it's going to be one of those things that ends up breaking Robin and Murphy up, since from what we've seen, Robin doesn't seem to want kids. Now, personally, I don't think it would get that far, but that sort of fundamental incompatibility definitely sounds like something that would be a deal breaker for anything long term.
I mean, I like your optimism of it not getting that far. But, you know, when the idea of kids being something to break them up came up, I didn't think that it would be because the relationship got far enough to discuss actually having children, but just that it's one of those kind of early dating things where you say the things you want to see if you're compatible or not.
Yeah. Because, I mean, they're both in their 30s. They've both been married before. It's going to make sense for them to have these conversations pretty early on, right?
Yeah. Murphy should add, hey, do you happen to be in love with anyone else to his list of questions?
He's going to be after this relationship ends.
Whoever he asks out next. Do you want to go out with me? Are you in love with someone else?
Yeah.
Aw. It makes me feel bad for him a little.
Yeah.
But I do think that him saying that his ex didn't want them is a sign that he probably does.
I agree.
But ultimately, I don't think the kids thing will be the thing that breaks them up, because I expect that to be the fact that she just can't give him her heart because it's already strikes.
Yeah, 1,000 times, yes.
This is going to be the episode I think back on after the running grave and think, oh man, Lindsay, you were so wrong. You sound like such an idiot. Because those definitely exist before Ink Black Heart.
Oh, for sure.
Oh man. And then the next thing that comes up is one of the things that ends up causing Strike a lot of pain by the end of this book. And that's when Robin agrees to go on a date with Murphy once he gets back from his holiday. And she thinks it's only a drink, said Ilse's voice in Robin's head. Nobody's saying you've got to jump into bed with him. And an image of Madeline Corson Miles flickered before Robin's eyes. And I'm just getting flashbacks back to Strike at Annabelle's, looking into Madeline's face and being reminded of Robin at the Ritz.
Yeah, there are so many parallels from this to both needing the shock of Madeline and Ryan Murphy to force them to admit their feelings. I wonder if that means that there will be parallels to Madeline with Murphy. It's hard to believe because I think that he's a better person than Madeline, but there was some issues with Madeline drinking a lot, or her behavior when she drank, I guess.
Oh, you might be onto something, because both their names do start with M.
Ah, M and M.
Regarding the alcohol thing, maybe the fact that Murphy tells her up front means that he is in a much healthier and non-crazy place, you know, than Madeline is. So he serves as a contrast rather than a comparison. Sort of like, hey, even when your partner does have it together and is cool, it's still going to be something missing, because you're in love with someone else, you dummy.
Yeah, that's definitely how I am imagining it is going to be. Because if he starts throwing things at Robin...
Hell no.
She's out.
Mm-mm. Hell no.
I do wonder whether Murphy being an alcoholic is going to factor in a negative way at any point in the future.
I know a lot of people have thought this. If I had to guess, I would say no. Of course, she always does the opposite of what I think, but I'm not expecting some evil side of him to surface, because I'm really just expecting the worst thing about him to be that he's not Strike. He's not the man she loves.
I super agree with you. I think that's going to be what ends up happening.
Again, we can come back to this episode when after we read The Running Grave and see y'all are idiots.
God. Yeah.
And my future self is thinking about my past self right now. And
my God, one day future Lindsay is going to have read The Grave.
And then we'll know.
Robin arrives back at her flat and Strike calls asking whether or not her offer of a bed is still available. And I love that she's both confused and pleased.
Oh, yeah. Her being pleased made me so happy. Because she was feeling kind of silly for suggesting it when Madeline exists. So him choosing to stay with her pleases her. And it's just so good.
It pleases her because she wants to be the main woman in his life, and pleases her because he chooses her, or, you know, just because she wants to hang out with him and have the post-bomb debrief, you know, all of the above.
All of the above.
All of the above.
I would like him to please her in other ways.
You and me both, sister.
We will get there.
Someday. I really wish that we could have heard Strike's thoughts about choosing to stay with Robin. Because if Robin hadn't offered, he'd probably have gone to a hotel. Mm-hmm. I don't think that he would ask Madeline. He's not making that mistake again.
Nope.
Like with Lorelai. But he is choosing Robin instead of Solitude. That's huge.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. I just would have loved to have heard his thought process there, because I wonder how telling it was.
Yeah. You know what? I never knew I needed this so badly before you said it, but yeah. Now I've heard it and I need mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, me too. I think I need to get myself an emotions closet.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, you know, cram in there together. I'm sure there's room.
Strike gives an update on Pat that makes me laugh. And this is after telling her that she needs to get an emergency appointment with her doctor. Mm-hmm. And he says, she told me to piss off, though not in those exact words. Probably thinks I'm accusing her of being too old to survive a door hitting her.
What were her exact words, I wonder?
Right?
Yeah, I'm curious too, because her telling him to piss off does sound mm-hmm. like her exact words from what we know of Pat. Maybe her words are even harsher.
Yeah, but probably also had four letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have loved to have actually read that.
That would have been so funny. Maybe she added in a wanker or a prat or something. Mm-hmm.
And then next, Robin tells Strike about the update from the Met about Ormond.
We saw Robin wrestling with her feelings and her doubt about Ormond being arrested earlier in this chapter, and I love that Strike immediately shares those doubts, and it says that Robin felt relieved. I'm trying to think of why I love this so much, her being relieved that Strike has the same doubts as her. I don't know, it's like they're a team. What is it? What do yeah. I love about this?
It's validation. It's the mm-hmm. sweet, sweet validation. It's confirmation that she and Strike are on the same page. Because
yeah.
they are a team and they're the best detective in London.
Yes,
and so
they
this
are.
This moment's just like, yes, this is why he's my partner. This is why we do this, because we both know something's fucky up in here.
And the very last line is, after telling her he'd be there by 6 because he needed to buy himself some essentials, Strike rang off. I cannot be the only one who knew that essentials, or one of the essentials things he needed to buy, was pajamas, because we all know.
That's funny, because I was thinking he had to go buy some condoms, but I guess he already has those.
Probably.
Shame he yeah. didn't bring them, get some use out of them. Next time, next sleepover. Fingers crossed.
Oh, those were good chapters.
So good. So much sweet shippiness after so many interviews last time.
Yeah, I know. So what are we doing in our next episode, Kens?
We are doing chapters 73 through 77, and those chapters have Strike staying the night at Robin's place and then interviewing Inigo Upcott.
And I think that Paula's going to be with us next time.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah, she is.
Nice. Ken's, that summary, it brought me up so high, and then it shot me down so low.
You know, I felt like I just needed to take you on an emotional roller coaster just to round off this
episode.
It was
a roller coaster, yeah.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.